هاولير أي أربيل.
This travel video is enthusiastically recommending that tourists come to Erbil, visit Kurdistan.
بخير بن سرجومان. أهلا وسهلا بكم.
With a gleaming city just west of the Zab River, the people of Kurdistan find themselves quite by surprise to be the envy of the crumbling war-torn Middle East that was once the center of the Ottoman Empire. With the help of U.S. forces, Kurds have managed to thrive in the north of Iraq, holding back ISIS in the west and maintaining peaceful relations with the Iranians to the east. Is this an unexpected golden age for the Kurds, who were denied their own nation after World War I when the European powers divided the spoils of that conflict to create modern Turkey, Syria, and Iraq? In the 1970s, during the Cold War, the U.S. made territorial promises to the Kurds, and then Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger abruptly betrayed those promises to pursue an alliance with the Shah of Iran. And we all know how that turned out. But the Kurds haven't forgotten their complicated history with the United States, and today, as U.S. air power and Kurdish soldiers are fighting together against ISIS and have significantly weakened ISIS's hold on the city of Mosul, can the Kurds trust that this alliance is for real? Veteran foreign correspondent Charles Glass traveled to the Kurdish and Arab Shiite front lines last fall for an article in this month's Harper's Magazine. He says the Kurds maintain a surprising optimism that these are the best of times.
To be fair to the Kurds, in many ways, the U.S. has guaranteed their semi-independence in the north. The no-fly zone from 1991 to 2003 allowed them to begin to build their state, which is now called the Kurdish Regional Government, an autonomous part of Iraq. And they're still relying on the U.S. to help them. However, right now, with the war against ISIS, the U.S. is helping them, but in a way that keeps them dependent on the U.S. That is, they can't move anywhere without U.S. airstrikes. The U.S. is not supplying them with the equipment that they need to fight independently. So that means that they have no protection against IEDs. They don't have the weapons to take out these suicide bombing trucks, armored trucks that ISIS sends against Kurdish positions to open them up. They don't have artillery. When I was there recently, all of the Kurdish military commanders were complaining of lack of supplies, lack of enough ammunition, and so forth. And they all believe it's so that the U.S. will keep them dependent, and they won't really be able to act against ISIS on their own. So they have U.S. special forces guiding some of their operations, and then they have U.S. air power clearing the ground for them when the U.S. is ready for them to make advances.
What capability do the Kurds have in fighting ISIS that's being restrained by the lack of equipment that you observed in their discussions with you?
Well, it means that it's very difficult for them to advance because ISIS is better armed. I mean, ISIS has the most up-to-date American weapons thanks to the fact that the Iraqi army abandoned them and they were able to take them. And also, ISIS is still receiving weapons, anti-tank weapons in particular, from Saudi Arabia. And it still receives ammunition through the Turkish border. So the Kurds are really outgunned. If they had the supplies that they need, they could fight very well and drive ISIS out of areas where Kurds are.
What's your assessment of the U.S. policy here? Is it a reaction to circumstances that the U.S. doesn't have the will to try to change? Or is there something nefarious at work here?
Probably both. I think that it began when the Arab Spring erupted in Syria in March of 2011, and the U.S. administration took the position that it would covertly arm and train Syrian rebels to overthrow the Syrian regime. And when that program began, most of the people who were willing to take up arms turned out to be jihadists who were not taking up arms because the Syrian government was undemocratic, which it was, but because it wasn't a Sunni fundamentalist government. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. helped to escalate the civil war. This created a vacuum in all of eastern Syria, which opened the way for the Islamic State of Iraq, as it was then called, to come in and then turning around and going back to Iraq where it came from and taking large parts of territory in Iraq, which then forced the U.S. to act because it was about to lose Erbil and Baghdad to this fanatic and very anti-American force created partly due to American policy.
You've described the U.S. policy as criminal.
I said it was either negligent or criminal in my article in Harper's Magazine, yes. And I think that it's criminal to treat the Kurds the way they've been treated. 90% of the Kurdish casualties are from IEDs. So what happens? They go into a town that they've driven ISIS out of, and ISIS has very effectively booby-trapped every building, every vehicle in the town. So they need young men to go in and dismantle those. And because they don't have the proper equipment to do it, they lose their limbs or they're killed. And I think that is criminal, because these are people that are ostensibly American allies and who are acting under American direction, and they're not being given the protection. The U.S. would not let its own soldiers go and dismantle those bombs without the proper equipment.
There are few American reporters with the kind of experience that you've had in Syria, seeing it at a time of peace amidst dictatorship, seeing it in conflict with the Israelis, seeing it in very different episodes of history. What's your assessment of what Syria could ever possibly be in this century?
I'm very pessimistic about what's happening in Syria. Because neither side has the strength to defeat the other, the war will go on and on. And the real problem for Syria is this war. And the existence of the war allows ISIS and similar groups to thrive. The war has to be stopped if anything good is going to come out of it. But much of the old Syria, and even under the dictatorship, there were good things in Syria. I mean, you lived amongst your neighbors. If you got involved in politics, you had real problems, as you do in any Arab state. The mistake that Syria made in the eyes of the United States and Israel was that it had a strategic alliance with Iran. And Assad, the father and the son, have relied on it to give it strategic depth in its dispute with Israel. The whole thing slightly came unglued when the U.S. did its own nuclear deal with Iran, and now American business wants to go back into Iran, and trading may well resume. So the raison d'etre for getting rid of Bashar is slightly gone, and I think that has left U.S. policy floundering ever since.
When you stand in Syrian territory or Iraqi territory and note the frontier that leads into ISIS territory, is that border solid? Is that border the kind of thing that is more tangible than the map lines drawn by Churchill, you know, at the end of World War I? Is it something that people are beginning to recognize that may have a permanence that is frightening?
Well, right now, there's about a 750-kilometer front line between ISIS and the Iraqi Kurds, and that is all now fortified. It's a huge land barrier built up with trenches below and barbed wire and trenches in front and landmines in front. The Kurds themselves still want to advance beyond that. But right now, that border is pretty solid.
Charles Glass, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Charles Glass is a Middle East reporter and author. You can read his latest piece, Disunified Front, on the Kurdish role in the fight against the Islamic State, in this month's Harper's Magazine.